The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
As the 16th century opened, Scotland was like a frontier. You look at the map here, and you can see that Scotland's indeed way up to the north in terms of people in Europe. It would be farthest away. And it was like a frontier area of civilized Europe. Ireland maybe even more so. Still in the 17th century, I've just been reading about Cromwell's going into Ireland and so forth. The English regarded the Irish as barbarians at that time, and pretty savage and so on, unfairly at a certain extent. But the Scots, likewise, were pretty much of an outpost of civilization. I don't know how many of you saw Braveheart. Let's just get a little indication. The time of William Wallace, the Scottish hero, in the early 1300s. That's early 14th century. But you have a little feel for what Scotland may have been like two centuries before the Reformation, the days of Edward I of England. Now, how many of you saw Rob Roy? Not many. Okay, a few. That's after the period we're studying, early 18th century, as described by Walter Scott and so on. Same beautiful country, but you get a little sense of how civilization might have proceeded by that time, just from Hollywood versions of it. But the Renaissance had barely reached Scotland. It's not as though they had no universities or education or anything like that, but it was not at the cutting edge. The culture was still largely medieval. You had a lot of landed nobility, still people who functioned more or less like serfs in the poorer population. The central government of the Stuart monarchy, which is eventually going to take over in England as well, in the person of James I in 1603 after Elizabeth dies. His ancestors were ruling in Scotland, but the central government was relatively weak. It didn't have much real clout vis-a-vis the nobility, who in their local domains would still be the controlling figures. Braveheart, you see Robert the Bruce and Argyle, or some of the, well, I guess Argyle's more in the Rob Roy thing, but you can see how these local nobles were still the powers in Scotland to a great extent. The church owned much land, which was really the basis of wealth and influence at the time, but the church tended to be controlled by this rather turbulent nobility in Scotland still as we come into the 16th century. Scotland also struggled for independence from external control. England had inflicted three defeats on her in the 16th century, and this thrust Scotland increasingly into the hands of England's rival, France. And so you tend to get alliances at this period of history, the early modern period, Scotland allying more with France versus England. Ireland tends to ally with Spain versus England at different times. So the threat was largely from England, and so these outposts of the British Isles would look for alliance to some of the continental powers. As Henry VIII broke from the Pope, there tended to be a stronger alliance between France and Archbishop James Beaton of St. Andrews. This would be the key churchman. His dates, you can see there, we don't even know the date of his birth. He died in 1539. And then his nephew, took over as his successor and was dignified by the papacy by being made a cardinal, David Beaton, probably born in 1494, and as we'll see, dies in 1546. And then James V, who reigned from 1513 to 1542, so almost the same time, almost chronologically the same time as Henry VIII in England. The last Henry, James V was a nephew of Henry VIII, and that's why the Stuarts eventually take over in England when the Tudor line comes to an end in Elizabeth. The Lollards survived in Scotland. These were the followers of John Wycliffe, who died in 1384, and much persecuted in England, but they managed, some of them survived in England too, but the movement spread up to the north into Scotland. These, remember, were Bible people, also ones who were Augustinian in their understanding of salvation, so really forerunners in a real sense of the Reformation, a group that would be ready to receive the views of Luther when they got to the British Isles. And they began, as we know from looking at the English Reformation, Luther's views began to enter the British Isles in the 1520s. Not only at places like Cambridge and Oxford, we saw the White Horse Inn, where Cranmer, Tyndale, Latimer, others like that had begun to discuss Luther's ideas in the 1520s, but also in Scotland. We have one who was a convert of Luther, Patrick Hamilton, a young man still, probably born in 1504, who had been to Wittenberg to study and was converted to Luther's views and came back to Scotland to spread these Protestant views and was burned at the stake on February 29th, 1528, still as a young man in his 20s. Likewise, in 1543, the Scottish Parliament had allowed the Bible to be read and translated, largely through English influence. You remember that this happened in Henry VIII's time in England, even though he was relatively conservative on some of the Catholic doctrine. But he did allow the Bible, through the influence of Thomas Cromwell, to be placed in the various local churches and finally made available, even though Thomas More had opposed that strenuously and persecuted people like William Tyndale. But likewise in Scotland, the Bible began to spread, but Cardinal Beaton opposed this, and French control soon prevailed, and another popular preacher, George Wishart, was burned at the stake on March the 2nd, 1546. You see, he was probably in his 30s. Again, the date of birth is uncertain, but probably around 1513. Following that, in retribution, really, on May the 29th, Cardinal Beaton was himself murdered, and his Protestant assassins took refuge in St. Andrew's Castle and took charge of the castle and rallied there. Other supporters of the Protestant views gathered there, knowing that there was going to be there would be repercussions from this assassination of Cardinal Beaton. And it's here in 1547 that the real hero of the Scottish Reformation first appears on the scene, and that's John Knox. We don't really know that much about the early life of John Knox. In fact, the date of his birth has even been disputed. It was thought to be 1507 for many years through a lot of history. 1505. And then when it came around to celebrating the 400th anniversary of his birth in 1905, some research determined that that couldn't be the date of his birth. I don't know all the reasons why. But they came up with 1514 instead, so actually about 9 years younger than people thought until the first part of this century, which just reveals that we don't know that much about his origins. At this time, in the 1540s, he was a Catholic priest. He was an ordained priest, and he had recently been converted to Protestant views, probably through the preaching of George Wishart. But we don't even know exactly the instrumentality of that. He was, in effect, a bodyguard of Wishart, and was ready to go with Wishart to Edinburgh when it was pretty clear that the authorities were going to arrest Wishart and put him to death, and Wishart persuaded him not to do that. And so Knox was still alive and able to rally to the castle at St. Andrews after this assassination. There's no indication he was implicated in the assassination himself, but he identified with the Protestant cause. Then once there, as they're in effect under siege in the castle, the French forces, the French Navy having come and so forth, he was called on to preach. He had never preached before, even though a Catholic priest. Main function was to perform the sacraments. And he took that burden upon himself with some trepidation, but found that he had clearly a gift from God for preaching God's word. And so he becomes recognized as a leader of the Scottish Protestants. They were captured by the French. Ultimately, the French forces prevailed, and Knox was taken as a prisoner, served for 19 months, more than a year and a half, as a galley slave on the French ships. Know something of what that condition was like. They would be forced to sleep under deck and very squalid and cramped quarters. They would be called on to do this tremendous labor with these long oars to move these ships in transoceanic sailing and so forth. Eventually, he was freed by the English as a matter of political negotiation, and this would be in the days of King Edward VI. And so certain exchanges were made between Protestants and Catholics, between English and French. And he then became one of the leaders in the reform of England in the days of King Edward VI. He was one of the major preachers recognized by people like Nicholas Ridley and others as one of the chief preachers at court and around the land. He preached extensively in the north of England, where you would expect, up near the border of Scotland, where his dialect would be readily accepted and recognized. And then he preached at court as well to King Edward VI himself and on many of his courtiers. He served on the committee to produce the 42 Articles, which shows that even people as astute as Thomas Cranmer and Nicholas Ridley, well-educated leaders of the English church, recognized his ability in doctrine, his intellectual ability. He was not always favored by Thomas Cranmer because Knox showed his Puritan spirit by objecting to, as the first book of Common Prayer had been produced by Cranmer, and then he had gotten, he solicited the critique of people like Martin Bucer and Peter Martyr Vermigli, who had come to Cambridge and Oxford, respectively, to suggest improvements in this first book of Common Prayer. And in order to produce a second book of Common Prayer, which would be more Protestant. And while that was still going through the process of being revised and printed up and so on, Knox objected to a part of it as a member of one of the reviewing committees, namely the part that had people kneel at communion. And he felt this smacked of transubstantiation, of recognizing that Christ was there in the elements of the communion in some mystical way. And therefore, a rubric was put into the Book of Common Prayer called the Black Rubric, because at the stage of printing, I guess the thing was reversed like a negative, so it stood out that although one might kneel at receiving the Lord's Supper, this did not suggest that there was any worship of the elements going on. And Cranmer felt this was unnecessary and was very unhappy with Knox's contribution. Even so, Knox was offered the bishopric of Rochester, and he refused this. He turned it down because he felt his gifts, well, we don't know all of the reasons why he turned it down, but probably he felt his gifts were not primarily administrative, that his calling was more to preach, and hence he would just get bogged down by taking on a bishopric, the episcopal function. Then when Mary Tudor came to the throne in 1553, Knox fled to the continent in the following year, 1554. Remember that this happened, a lot of people were apprehended right away. Many of them were charged with marriage of clergy. That was the violation on basis of which many of the reformers were arrested. And then various other charges were trumped up as the Catholics took over once again. But many of them saw the handwriting on the wall and escaped to the continent while they could. And Knox was among those. He went first to Frankfurt, where he furthered reform and worship. In other words, went beyond the Second Book of Common Prayer, revising it still further in a Protestant direction, what he felt was more true to Scripture. And gathered a church of English-speaking refugees together there in Frankfurt. Then some more came subsequently who objected to changing. They felt maybe out of principle, but maybe just out of expediency, that it was not wise to depart from the authorized Book of Common Prayer. Their hope would be that once Mary was passed from the scene, they could come back, and they didn't want to be different now. It's sort of like when the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was formed in 1936. The desire was to change, go back to an earlier form of the Westminster Standards, since the Northern Presbyterian Church had added certain amendments in the early part of the 20th century. And there were some who felt, no, it would be wiser to stick with what we have, so that as more people join in and so forth, we won't have to present them with some new version. Well, the general feeling was to get rid of those amendments that were made to accommodate the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, which it, when it came in, that went kind of in an Arminian direction. And the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and now the PCA also has settled on an earlier 20th century form, the Westminster Standards. The Bible Presbyterian Church then, I think, made a mistake in revising some of the standards to go in a explicitly premillennial direction. And that was not wise. But by then, most of the property disputes over church buildings and so on had been settled. But here, too, the idea of the ones who were under the leadership of Bishop Edward Cox, who had come across to Frankfurt, felt, let's stick with the Second Book of Common Prayer. And so you got a dispute in Frankfurt between the Coxians and the Knoxians. And this is sometimes written up under the heading, The Troubles at Frankfurt. They sought advice. Calvin urged that they use moderation. And Knox essentially lost out. He turned out to be in the minority. And so he moved on from Frankfurt then to Geneva. And here he really felt at home. He marveled at the reform as it was in place by then. Here we are in the mid-1550s. Calvin really has been able to take charge. Most of the opposition has withdrawn or melted away in Geneva. So in the last 9 years of his life, Knox could view Calvin's work as the most perfect school of Christ to be found in this world. So he was very content and led a church then of English refugees in Geneva. This is the period where you could have taken your choice on a Sunday, or actually many days of the week, to go hear Calvin preach in one church, or Knox preach in another, or several of the other leading reformers that were around. Sharon?
What was the date of his going to Geneva?
I don't have the precise date, but it would be 1555, I think. Yeah, that's what I referred to, because I think he was in Frankfurt for the better part of 1 year after going there in 1554. Scotland now was under the regency of Mary of Lorraine, she's normally called, or Mary Guise. The Guise family, you may recall from your reading about the situation in France, were devoutly Catholic people who were from the aristocracy in France and had a great influence on the throne of France, while not themselves of the royal line. But Mary Guise had married James V, and he had now died. You see, he died in 1542. And so she was governing in Scotland as a regent. That is, not the actual reigning monarch, but the one in effect in charge. Usually meant that several of the nobility would be advising and running the government. But she was at least the figurehead. She is the mother of the eventual Mary Queen of Scots, also known as Mary Stuart, who is going to be the great opponent of John Knox in due course. Now, the Marys here get rather confusing. You've got these two in the Scottish context, and you also have Mary Tudor reigning in England at this time, 1553 to 1558. She's the one that's usually known as Bloody Mary because of all the martyrdoms in her reign in England. So these are to be distinguished from that one. Knox did return to Scotland for 6 months in 1555. Just to sort of see how things were, to see what the possibilities were for reform.
So you can say clear about the marrying Lorraine, because the king of Scotland right now is James V.
He's died. But if you look at his dates, Joe, he died in 1542.
And how about the Mary?
Mary was his wife.
Oh, his wife?
Yeah. And so she's a widow, and the mother of Mary, Queen of Scots, Mary Stuart. So Knox goes back to Scotland for 6 months of 1555, but clearly the time was not ripe yet for reform to take hold. He does write a work that is not one the feminists care for today, The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. Now, if you see the situation, he's got Mary Guise, or Mary of Lorraine, in charge of Scotland, Mary Tudor in charge of England, and the imminent Mary Queen of Scots. This is why he's writing such a thing against the regiment, means the rule of women. And he develops a scriptural argument against having women in charge. The impolitic thing about writing such a thing at this time is the fact that the heir apparent in England is Elizabeth. And he clearly offended Elizabeth by this publication. In fact, Calvin apologized to the government of England for this writing that had come from Geneva, from John Knox's pen, and felt it was didn't represent his views on the whole situation. Well, as a result of this, when Elizabeth did come to the throne of England in 1558, she would not allow John Knox back in. She was never happy about that. So Knox continued in Geneva as pastor of the English-speaking refugee church there until May of 1559. At that time, resentment in Scotland was high at Mary Stuart's marriage to the French prince, who would become eventually King Francis II of France. And this now gave occasion for resistance to be possible to the Catholic rule in Scotland. England was ready to help because Elizabeth, remember, was herself, even though she had some sympathies with a high church type of worship and so on, she was viewed by the Pope as illegitimate, and she was therefore naturally thrown into the arms of the Protestants, and the Pope actually gave Catholics the right to assassinate her if they had the opportunity. So then with the death of the regent, Mary Guise, Mary of Lorraine, in June of 1560, things were settled in Scotland in favor of Protestantism, English influence backing this up. So here comes Knox then to Scotland as the opportunity now is ripe to bring in the Protestant Reformation. In August of 1560, the Scottish Parliament adopted the Scots Confession, largely framed by John Knox, although it was done by a committee of, I forget, five or six preachers, all of whom had the first name of John. And they produced in very short time, the Scots Confession. I urge you, when you have an occasion, have an opportunity, read the Scots Confession. Read just part of it. Yeah, because when you compare this with the Westminster Confession, the content is very consistent. It's reformed in doctrine, but the tone and the spirit of it are quite different. The whole style of it, quite different. You're familiar with the Westminster Confession, how concise and precise it is in expressing reformed doctrine. The Scots Confession is sensational. It's exciting reading. It's fresh. It's vivid. You have this feeling that this has been hammered out in the realities of life right at the moment. It has several interesting things about it as well. For instance, in the subject that we've discussed several times of the notes or marks of the true church, I've mentioned this before, Knox makes very clear that for the Scottish church, there are three marks of the true church. The preaching of the word, the right preaching of the word, the right administration of the sacraments, and the exercise of discipline. So the third point, which we've seen implicit in Zwingli and Calvin, is made very explicit in the Scots Confession of John Knox and the others. Then in December of 1560, along the same line of what I've just mentioned, a distinctive part of the Scottish Reformation is produced. The first Book of Discipline was adopted. So here the standards of the Scottish Church move into the realm of church government, which is going to be of particular emphasis in the Scottish context. Then in 1561, by the way, there is subsequently a second Book of Discipline that goes beyond the first and so on, as Presbyterianism gets more and more carefully defined as the years go by. We'll make reference to that in a subsequent lecture to one of Knox's successors, Andrew Melville, as part of the backdrop then for the Westminster Assembly. In 1561, after this first year of great progress for the Protestant Reformation in Scotland, Mary, Queen of Scots, returned to her realm. She was the legitimate heir to the throne. There was no male heir to James V, only Mary Stuart. And she now was widowed. Her young French husband, Francis II, had died early. And so she was left as a widow. Most of the Hollywood versions of the confrontation between Mary, Queen of Scots, and John Knox will always have great sympathy now for this charming, beautiful, young, widowed princess now returning to this realm where you are confronted now by, in one of the films I remember seeing, had this bearded prophet, you know, you see him just in silhouette on top of the hill, tirading away, you know, and she's got to deal with this kind of fanatic. That's the usual presentation. She celebrated Mass in her private chapel, and this became the occasion for confrontation, because it's violated now the accepted religious rules of her realm. Roland Bainton, although not particularly a friend of the Reformed or Presbyterian point of view, makes this comment on page 182 of our textbook. You've read this by now. The ensuing altercation between the pretty girl and the tirading reformer evokes no sympathy for Knox in an age which has forgotten what it was all about. And that's where we are. Particularly now in our postmodern age. These issues seem very strange to people in our culture today. Mary and Knox engaged in a series of four interviews and then a fifth thing, a trial of Knox for treason, which were essentially confrontations between secular authority and the Lord's authority. At the first interview, and we have this actually from Knox's own History of the Reformation in Scotland, this took place on August 26, 1561, in the paperback version, which I think is published by Banner of Truth, I'm not sure of that. It's on pages 279 to 280. Mary says, "Well then, I perceive that my subjects shall obey you and not me. They shall do what they list and not what I command. And so must I be subject to them and not they to me." Knox said, "God forbid that ever I take upon me to command any to obey me or yet to set subjects at liberty to do what pleaseth them. My travail is that both princes and subjects obey God. Think not, madam, that wrong is done you when ye are willed to be subject to God. It is he that subjects peoples under princes and causes obedience to be given unto them. Yea, God craves of kings that they be foster fathers to his kirk and commands queens to be nurses to his people. This subjection, madam, unto God and unto his troubled kirk is the greatest dignity that flesh can get upon the face of the earth, for it shall carry them to everlasting glory." Mary, "Yea, but ye are not the kirk that I will nurse. I will defend the kirk of Rome, for it is, I think, the true kirk of God." Knox, "Your will, madam, is no reason. Neither doth your thought make that Roman harlot to be the true and immaculate spouse of Jesus Christ. Wonder not, madam, that I call Rome an harlot. For that kirk is altogether polluted with all kind of spiritual fornication, as well in doctrine as in manners. Mary, my conscience is not so." Knox, "Conscience, madam, requireth knowledge, and I fear that right knowledge ye have none." Well, that's a pretty bold confrontation, and you can see why Hollywood makes of it what they do. But Philip Schaff makes this comment, "The pulpit proved mightier than the throne. Had Mary's popish policy triumphed, there would have been an end to Protestantism and liberty in Scotland, and probably in England too. And we might add America, because that's where most of the religious heritage of this continent, North America, came from." As you know, through a series of romantic follies and misfortunes, which we won't try to trace in detail, Bainton gives some account of it, and McNeil will later on in the reading, Mary was eventually forced to abdicate, escaped really to England, leaving her one-year-old son, James VI, behind, who will eventually, growing up under Presbyterian tutelage in Scotland, become King James I of England, King James of the King James Bible, and so on. He's the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. But Mary goes south to England to be given refuge by her cousin, Elizabeth, really very much confined under house arrest most of the time. And because she's still politically active, she's all kinds of Catholic plots tend to swirl around Mary Stuart. You remember Philip II was trying to retake England and so on. And in 1567, she was clearly implicated in traitorous acts, and so Elizabeth had her executed. She was beheaded for treason. That's in 1587. She was really in England for 20 years, from 1567 to 1587. And it's that causes Philip to launch his Spanish Armada against England, when his last hope of really gaining England by means of Mary Stuart being a key to it. Then he launches this great fleet, which in God's providence was defeated by the more navigable, maneuverable English ships, and a fortunate providential wind drove the Spanish fleet over towards the coast of the Netherlands. Much of them were shipwrecked. They went all the way around the north. Many of them were shipwrecked around by Ireland. Very few of them got all the way back to Spain in 1588. Now, a few words about the legacy of John Knox. Knox was not totally successful in all that he set out to do. Not many figures in history are. He wanted to have the church lands, particularly the monastic lands, just as in England Henry VIII abolished the monasteries, and that suddenly provided a lot of wealth to be distributed to people he wished to favor. Knox's idea was that the church lands would be used to endow public schools. He wanted to see all of the populace of Scotland educated. He himself apparently, we don't know again, but apparently came from rather a lower class peasant background. And he wished to see all of Scotland educated so they could be educated in the word and in the gospel. The nobility did not allow this to take place completely. They always resisted. In England, this was true to a great extent even in Edward VI's day, that he wasn't able to get the former Roman Catholic church lands used for all the purposes of reform that he sought. But Scotland came closer to universal education than any other land, and it was for Christian purposes, basically so that they could read the Bible. Wallace Notstein is a historian who makes this comment: "Those who have observed the Scottish peasantry have remarked again and again that their ability to argue points of religion was extraordinary. Their knowledge of the Bible and their ability to quote it never failed to amaze travelers. The Scots were trained from youth up in their religion as probably no other people in Europe." Now, when you consider that at the beginning of this century, this was the outback land, in effect, culturally and educationally. But a century later, and on into the 17th and 18th centuries, what Notstein is talking about was recognized by many continental travelers in Scotland. Jacques Barzun, who taught for a long time at Columbia University, makes this comment: "Remember that the finest educational system, from grammar school to university, the system that produced some of the greatest and strongest minds in the Western world," and then he names people like David Hume, Adam Smith, Robert Burns, Walter Scott, John Napier, who was the inventor of logarithms, not all heroes for the Christian faith, but bright people. He says, the system that produced some of the greatest and strongest minds in the Western world was established by the poorest country of Europe and supported, in the proud phrase, on a little oatmeal. I refer to Scotland after the Reformation. This miracle the Scots accomplished by the simple expedient of knowing what they wanted to do and doing it." W. Stanford Reid, who served on our board here for some time. I think is still living. Somebody correct me if you know he died recently. Was connected with the University of Guelph in Ontario in more recent years. He wrote a biography of Knox, published in 1974, entitled Trumpeter of God. And he credits Knox with establishing concern for the poor in the Scottish church. Not just education, but here more diaconal type ministry, ministries of mercy. Knox's confidence came from assurance of God's authority. This is the thing that impresses you as you read John Knox and as you watch his ecclesiastical career. Knox stands as the outstanding illustration of the fact that belief in God's sovereignty, far from making one passive, inspires one to forceful action. One contemporary said, he put more life into his hearers from the pulpit in an hour than 600 trumpets. And when he was old, and if the date of his birth now is correct, around 1514, he died before he was 60, so he wasn't all that old, but for that time, that was considered an advanced age. But when he was in his latter days, he had to be lifted into the pulpit. But before the close, he became so animated and vigorous that he seemed, in the words of a contemporary, likely to ding the pulpit into blads and fly out of it. So this is a vigorous style of preacher, as you can imagine from just hearing some of his words. In his theory of godly revolution, he went beyond Calvin's position of resistance to tyranny through the lesser magistracy. Knox went beyond Calvin in two respects. One was that he taught that it didn't have to be just through the lesser magistracy. It could be done as the people collectively. And the other thing was, not only was there a right of such resistance to tyranny, but there was a duty to resist tyranny. Specifically, if the government supported idolatry and blasphemy, then the Christian people should rise up against that, had a duty to rise up against that. So here's a much more revolutionary spirit than we've seen in John Calvin. And that tends to characterize the Scottish Presbyterian tradition down into more modern times. Here in America, for example, while the colonists in the period of the American Revolution were somewhat divided, the Episcopal Church here tended naturally to be more loyal to the British side. The Presbyterians, as far as I've been able to ascertain, at least the clergy, there may have been exceptions among the lay people, were 100% in support of the American Revolution. Now, there are a lot of explanations for that, not just Knox's theoretical views, but also the Scottish versus English sentiment. So a certain kind of nationalism enters into that as well. But It fits with Knox's approach. I'll say more about that when we come to the Scottish Covenanters, where I think they tended to go over the line in this regard in church and state relations. The epitaph given at Knox's graveside was, "Here lies he who never feared the face of man." And the reason is that he feared God and paid total respect to his word. When Knox was dying, Calvin already had been in the grave for 8 years. This is now 1572. The Dutch were battling the Spaniards, and that the outcome of that had not yet been determined. The Lutherans were battling the papal and imperial forces, and eventually that would carry on into the 30 Years' War of 1618 to 48. So the outcome for the Reformation was not that clear on the continent. And regarding the Reformed people in France, word came in August of the year in which Knox died of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre of the Huguenots in Paris and then throughout much of France. So 1572, things are still not all that clear as to whether the Protestant Reformation will survive. And I think we can be thankful for a spirit like that of Knox that instilled great courage and assurance into the hearts of many to survive now these further 400 years down to our day. Well, let's take the break now. The bell's rung, and come back, and any questions relating to this material and then anything so far this semester will be legitimate. So we'll try to review. Between Knox and Calvin on the civil magistrate issue and resistance to tyranny. One was that Calvin stressed that it must be done through the lesser magistracy. And Knox was saying, no, you don't have to have that as long as the people are operating corporately, not individuals. You can't have individuals rise up and rebel. But they have to do it collectively. Now, that's sort of vague, actually. And the problem is, how do you know when the people collectively have decided that this is tyrannical government? And in Scotland, it's more plausible, especially when you have a strong leader like John Knox, to have a sense this is where the people want to go. You get into a larger political entity without that kind of leadership, and very, very hard to prove unless you have some kind of democratic poll or something. It's almost like Jean-Jacques Rousseau's general will. You know, he wanted things to be governed by according to the general will. Well, how do you determine what the general will is? That's not so easy to do, even in a society like ours. It's very, very hard to know. The other one was clear enough, I think. What was the other one? The duty rather than just the right to rebel when the government was guilty of idolatry and blasphemy. So that's the other thing that Knox goes beyond Calvin by degree, but it was the first one that I didn't make clear enough in the earlier discussion. Let's open it up for any questions then that would help prepare you for the test. Trey? It's less a matter of competency than the latter, that the scriptures prohibit this. And when there was a woman in charge, that thing, I guess this does raise a question of competency. But he goes through various biblical examples of when women were in charge, like Athaliah in Judah and Jezebel in Israel and so on, that you had disastrous consequences. So it's more a scripture-based argument. And I think he felt sincerely this shows what the will of God is with regard to governing. Calvin, at least in terms of modern politics, was quite willing to accept Queen Elizabeth as reigning in England as not something contrary to Scripture. So he was generally more moderate on a whole gamut of issues than Knox would tend to be. And yet they're still within the Reformed camp doctrinally. Yeah. Mike?
When was Francis I? When was his reign?
He's almost contemporary with Henry VIII. I don't have the precise dates in mind just now, but very much contemporary, long reign like that of Henry VIII and roughly the same dates.
Okay. And Philip the Hess, I imagine he's in Germany, and that he kind of was a Lutheran. And I don't really understand how him and Prince Frederick.
Okay. Philip of Hesse is another one of these German rulers. His area is what's called the Palatinate. This map here will show it a little more clearly. Let's see. We get Marburg. Here's the word Hesse. You can see this yellow part. You can see how things operated, where you had these little separate duchies and principalities. And it's basically along the Rhine, what's called the Palatinate. And some of these boundaries were shifting all the time, too. If somebody died and a marriage took place or whatever, then you'd get these boundaries moving around, because they were more a matter of personal allegiance than they were a nation with clear-cut boundaries as we understand things in more modern times. But he was one of the electors at one point for the empire. So one of the key rulers in Germany was at the various diets that were called, and where the protest was given. He was one of the main figures at that Diet of Speyer in 1526. And so he's on a par with Frederick of Saxony, although not necessarily agreeing. Now, what happens in that territory of the Palatinate is that it becomes a kind of merger of Lutheran and Reform. You can see Philip of Hesse's spirit by calling the Marburg Colloquy is, hey, let's get our act together, you Protestants. Let's, if nothing else, for survival's sake, or self-defense. So that tends to be the spirit. And then you get the Heidelberg Catechism. Where's Heidelberg? Heidelberg's here. Now, this is what's actually labeled the Palatinate at this time, with Hesse here. And that's a Reformed document. But the idea there was to try to merge the views of Melanchthon and Calvin as much as possible and bring them together. Would have given more military support. Yeah, that's right. And we don't know what the outcome might have been still, but it would have tended to tip the scale more favorably. That's why Zwingli was that concerned to try and achieve an alliance at that time. There's one thing more I wanted to say about that. It slips my mind right now, but let's go ahead and take other questions. David, you had one. Well, the French Revolution, of course, was horrible in some of its methods. I mean, they're shocking to us. Actually, the guillotine was a rather humane way of executing, relatively speaking. In fact, it may be a better way of executing than the kinds we use today. If you read much about part of the problem, this is getting off the track, but part of the problem in our day is that those who perform capital punishment don't do it very often, and they find the electric chair isn't working right, or the gas chamber, or the method that's used, and sometimes it's pretty ghastly. And the guillotine at least did its job. The Dr. Guillotine, who invented it, intended it to be a humane method. A lot surer than some guy with an axe who might lose his balance and end up putting it in the middle of your back or something. Sorry about that. But those things could happen. The French Revolution, of course, in terms of general consequences, was probably something most of us would view as a good thing. Overcoming it, this is jumping down a couple of centuries of history from where we've been, but the statement made about the French aristocracy of the time of Louis XV, or even his father Louis XIV, who the great privilege was of the nobility was to be there at Versailles and maybe hold the great king's bathrobe while he got dressed, you know, this sort of thing. And one statement was that the nobility had the great accomplishment of being born into their class. That was all they really did. And so to have that privileged class removed from its position and to have the majority of people gain more political role and so on was probably generally beneficial. France, of course, is having had such a radical reformation, has tended to go back and forth. The pendulum has swung back and forth. 19th and 20th century, so it wasn't nearly as stable. Ours was really a more conservative revolution. So there are many benefits from that. But Knox's view is more radical, and I think wrong, really. We get to the Covenanters. I'll say more about that. But I think the Covenanters who rose up in rebellion, took the sword in the name of Christ, were doing what Christ did not intend. And it's a difficult question, because some people would say, well, you know, we would never use military or political methods, violence, force, unless we're being persecuted. And I think that's exactly the time when you're not to use it. That's when Christ tells us to turn the other cheek and to be ready to be martyrs and so forth. Now, the difficulty is that church and state were so combined in the minds of people at this time. They really had not made a proper distinction. You still had the concept of Christendom. And so it's very easy to understand why Knox comes out the way he does. He's just, in his view, trying to be zealous for the Lord. But if you give people license to take up the sword in the name of Christ, you're really back in the crusading spirit again. And rather than convert Muslims, you wipe them out. And I think it's not the spirit that Christ wanted. But that's certainly subject for discussion. Trey?
Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about Knox's conversion? Not his conversion, but his call to the ministry?
Well, why don't you say what you know about it? Because I'm not sure I have that much detail about that.
I just vaguely remember reading something to the
effect
of
I can't add or subtract, really. I don't know whether that's got good factual base or not. Knox is the kind of figure, somewhat like George Gillespie, that we'll come to in the context of the Westminster Assembly, around whom legends tend to develop. So yeah, you need to take a little bit of a critical view of some of these stories, although I came out concluding that some about Gillespie in the Westminster Assembly may well have been true. So you don't want to just cast them aside because they sound so exciting and thrilling. But I don't know. The context, as I understand it, of Knox's call to preach was in the besieged castle of St. Andrews, and it was something like what you've described, but I've never heard that specific detail about it. And it may be true, but I'd have to look at Knox's own account of the history of the Reformation. I can't remember whether he documents it that much or not. Okay, well, that may be right, and my memory just may not be sharp enough. But it certainly was something that he had not preached until that time, and then he was called upon suddenly and without his putting himself forward to preach, and then found that he did have this great gift. In fact, Knox has been, in the whole question about charismatic gifts, there's some interesting things that come up about Knox, because he claimed to have a gift of prophecy, and he did make some rather specific predictions, usually of God's judgment on people, rulers sometimes, lesser rulers who were resisting the Reformation, and he made a pronouncement. And by Samuel Rutherford's time, the Westminster Assembly, people like Rutherford, Scottish religious leaders, regarded these as bona fide prophetic gifts. Not that Knox had a gift of prophecy that was always operative, as it would have been with the apostles, let's say. But they recognized extraordinary gifts of that nature. That's from one of the members of the Westminster Assembly. So it's kind of interesting to see that. And I showed that to Dr. Ferguson one time, and he had not seen it before, but he smiled and shook his head and said, there's always something to complicate things, isn't there? Yeah, and it's true. There are interesting issues. Philip of Hesse, once again, the thing I was about to get into when we were talking about him a moment ago, was about his bigamy. And again, this is something that reveals the kind of groping nature of the Reformation, to struggle with what does the Bible really teach on some of these issues. We've seen how Henry VIII at least had a rationale for his divorce, various scripture proofs that he could turn to. Likewise with Philip's bigamy, I think it's been described in the reading already, and you may recall that it may come later on in Bainton. I can't remember now just where it appears. But he was, again, one of these arranged marriages. I think Philip was younger than his wife. There was no affection between them, and maybe she even wasn't engaging in sexual relations. And so he had a problem. And he turns to the reformers, since he's identified with them, to get their advice. And Luther and Melanchthon both, and I guess Bucer also, all recommended marry another wife, get a second wife. And what would their scriptural basis be for that? They had one. The patriarchs, yeah, the multiple marriages among the Old Testament patriarchs. So if God could allow it then, who's to say it's not ideal, but it may be as good an answer under these circumstances as there can be. They didn't favor a divorce in that situation. So you can see how they're struggling. Now, Calvin, again, is the most reliable one. I don't know that he had anything to do with Philip of Hesse's problem, but when you get his commentary on the New Testament passage, what Christ says about marriage and divorce and so on, he would never fall into that sort of expedient, as far as I know. I can't speak in blanket terms. But there again, it's just another reminder of the fact they'd rediscovered the gospel. They wanted to have the scriptures as their total authority. But there are a lot of problem situations that could arise that they didn't have an immediate good answer to. They had to explore a bit more.
How is the nuns interacting with Anabaptists and the Puritans in the
nation? Yeah, on the latter score, Knox is sometimes called a Puritan. And it's one reason why his successors in Scotland can relate so well to the English Puritans at the time of the Westminster Assembly. They're really on the same wavelength. The next lecture I give is on the origins of Puritanism, and we'll see what it was that really was motivating that movement in England. Basically, it was to make the Reformation go further in a biblical direction. And you can see that's...
You say the second point, the corporate, since congregation means it's very... Is there any connection? Congregationalism?
What is it that you saw in Knox that seemed to go in the direction of congregationalism?
The first point you said...
Oh, about the people, rather than the lesser magistracy. Yeah, it's a more democratic impulse there, in a sense, than you have in Calvin. But remember, he's talking about the people corporately, not as individuals. That means nationwide. So you'd still get, in Scottish Presbyterianism, the idea of a national church, not each congregation being a rule unto itself. So the Scots were very much opposed, when we get to the Westminster Assembly time, to the independents who favored congregational polity. And really, Presbyterianism, while it develops to a certain extent in Switzerland with Calvin, it really develops fully in Scotland. That's where it has more freedom and opportunity. Well, it's hard to say, because it does go back and forth, because the bishops get restored in Scotland for a period of time as well. But basically, the idea of graded courts of the church is there are really three basic principles to Presbyterian polity while we're on it. One is that there's a collegiality of government, not one-man rule, as in episcopacy. The second, and that includes the fact that you have lay leaders, not just ordained ministers, but lay leaders joined with the ministers in governing the local church and at every level. That's really the second principle, is the office of the ruling elder. It's one of the distinctives of Presbyterianism that you find in other forms of Protestantism, something approaching that, but never as clearly worked out and as functional as it is in most places with Presbyterianism. The third is the idea of graded courts of the church, so that you have a local body of elders governing the local church, and then the regional government to which the local church is accountable, presbytery, or the classes in the Dutch terminology. And then the national level, whether you call it a general assembly or a synod, the same thing, that you'd have a national body to which the regional bodies are accountable. And those are the three basic principles of Presbyterian government. Knox and the Scottish Presbyterians don't come at it with it all well formed from the beginning. It evolves gradually, but you do have in Knox the idea of, and this is something that we need to remember in our day, polity always has to be, in a sense, pragmatic. It has to be what works in the given circumstances. And Knox was nothing else if not practical. He had what he called superintendents who would go with powers of evangelist into the remote corners of the land where you don't have a functioning presbytery yet, and they would have the powers of an evangelist to establish churches as people were converted, and then a church would get established. It'd be like a bishop in that territory until, it was always temporary, it was until the church was organized well enough, there were enough people for a presbytery to be formed. And then he would remove himself back to the original status of on a par with any other elder. But he saw the need for that. And I think we shouldn't be so rigid in the way we understand Presbyterianism today. We can't do something similar when that's the way to get the Lord's work done. But it should be well defined, both in time limits and power limits and so forth. Because there's always the danger of one man rule getting carried away. Other questions or comments, David?
Look mystic at times.
Well, there are some examples of that that Bainton gives. And the French history of the wars, they're so confusing, I can't keep them all straight. But there is one account Bainton gave where after the Huguenots had gained authority to hold services in certain locations, this nobleman came upon them and they were having this worship service in a barn. And he wants to call it to a halt, whereas they were having a legitimate service. But then they hurl all kinds of epithets at him and so on, start throwing rocks or whatever. And that's, I think Calvin would agree with you. The trouble is, this is often the situation we face where you'll have a leader who articulates things theologically, soundly, and according to Scripture, and his followers can't always be relied on to carry it out that way. And it's always the problem of judging one's leader by his followers. They often will carry things farther theoretically beyond the bounds that he had in mind, and their implementation in practice will not be with the same spirit. So I think it's fair to say, I'm not an expert on the French Huguenot history. I admire them greatly for their standing under horrible persecution, particularly in the after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in Louis XIV's time. So I don't want to dishonor them at all, but you're quite right in sensing that the theory went beyond Calvin. And you can see in Calvin a certain development of his thought also. The last edition of the Institutes is 1559, 5 years before his death. He writes his commentary on Daniel, I believe, in 1561 or 2. And that's a later place where he comments on this type of issue. And as Daniel gives many instances of Daniel refusing to do what the civil government wants him to do, you know. And so Calvin has opportunity, I think it's on the ninth chapter, but maybe the seventh chapter, where he comments on giving a hint that the persecution that had been happening to his followers in France had made him think a little more in the direction of resistance. And makes it sound as though he's saying you have a right to do more in the direction of defending yourself and so on. Scott Amos, one of our THM students who works in the library and so on, has written a paper recently on Calvin's view about political resistance. And he concludes that he was still pretty consistent in the cautious or conservative direction on this. But then you read some of the later Huguenots, and they do definitely go farther in a radical direction, more like Knox. Some of the early English Puritan figures, likewise, are not that different from Knox, although they're not the mainstream of the English Puritans. And you get Calvin almost always is counseling more moderate stance on any controversial issue. So take your time, see what the Lord is teaching you. If this isn't a chastisement, don't make waves about secondary issues. It's partly his maturity and his sense of priorities of always seeing the gospel as the key issue. And it's a good reminder to us and why Calvin, I think, is still the soundest guide for us on most of the, out of all these reformers. Yes, David.
Could you comment on Uri Gimeno Presbyterianism?
Yeah, we'll have occasion to do that more in the Westminster Assembly because this is really the big controversy of that time between the independents and the Scottish Presbyterians who came, who were Jure Divino Presbyterians, that is, Presbyterianism by divine right, and the more moderate English Presbyterians were not yet fully persuaded that Presbyterianism was the only scriptural form of church government. Some of the authorities on the Westminster Assembly feel that's the tragic flaw of the whole thing. That's where they got hung up, that both sides were trying for a divine right position, either Presbyterian or congregational. And hence, each one's working on the basis of principle. There's no room for compromise. And if they only could have reached some kind of accommodation, it may well be they would have left a Puritan form of church for England for the generations to come. But it didn't work out. What I would say about it is that the three principles that I enunciated a moment ago are Jure Divino. Those are things that the Scripture sets down that I think are clear principles of church government. It's when you push beyond that that I think you get into trouble. And again, you have to be aware that always polity is a secondary issue to the gospel. And to many other things like the Trinity and doctrines of that nature. So you can see that the Lord has seen fit to use a variety of forms of government through the history of his people. It's sort of like when the Israelites wanted monarchy and Samuel took it hard, and it wasn't the Lord's ideal, and yet at least their motivation for it was not right. They wanted to emulate the nations around them. And yet the Lord had good intentions for using monarchy as well. So the Lord has worked with a variety of forms of government, and I don't think that's ever the major issue. So we ought to be ready to yield a point here and there and then try to instruct people as to the principles in the Word. Now, the Westminster Divines were at a point in history where they're trying to set up the church as better reformed than it had been. And naturally, you want to then bring in all the scriptures that bear on it. The Scots were rather careful not to push divine right from the beginning of the discussions in the Westminster Assembly. And it wasn't until the independents had resisted to a greater point that they started trying to impose it. And then partly Parliament, knowing this was going to be a controversy, Parliament tried to force the Assembly by sort of asking the question, what is by divine right? And then they had to answer. But for a long time, knowing that they had differences on that point, they tried to steer around it. And the fault lies on both sides, I think, as to why the thing broke down.
Did both sides claim the historic reformers, such as Calvin?
No, the Presbyterian side would, but it's interesting. One of the sort of gentlemen's agreement in the Westminster Assembly is that they would not quote authorities. When somebody started bringing in Augustine or Calvin or somebody else, they'd sort of brush it aside and say, we're trying to settle this on the basis of Scripture. So occasionally it comes up in the arguments, and probably when all of them agreed, they didn't mind quoting some authority like Augustine or Calvin, but they were really committed to the idea we're going to try to work through all of these things on the basis of Scripture alone. Now the Congregationalists knew they were innovative. They were conscious of that. And what happened in New England, this is all again getting ahead of the story, none of this will be on the test tomorrow, but in New England, where the experiment had moved ahead, by the time of the Westminster Assembly, there was a lot of interest. What's happening over there in Massachusetts and Connecticut? And is it working? So John Cotton, who had been one of the influential English Puritans, writes a couple of works, The Keys of the Kingdom and The Way of the Congregational Churches, that are published in London right in the 1640s. And it's a big argument on the independent side that, see, it can work after all. And Rutherford, the Scottish delegate, writes his Do Right of Presbytery against that point of view. And then you get Roger Williams coming over, who'd been kicked out of Massachusetts. He comes over to get the charter for Rhode Island and writes his Bloody Tenet of Persecution, which is an embarrassment to the Congregationalists because it shows they can persecute too. They weren't really committed, while the independents are trying for toleration, you see, in England. So it's a confused thing, but the Congregationalists basically recognized that they were not consistent with the earlier reformers, but they felt they were going back to the real New Testament form. That's the issue. That's the important thing. So we'll get to a lot of that further on. Mike?
There was just two dates. The Act of Supremacy, I was wondering when that actually...
Yeah, 1534.
And then in 1536, up in the Six Articles?
1539. At the Wartburg. I don't remember exactly. He's whisked off there right after the Diet of Worms, which is April 1520.
Is it just a couple of years?
I think it's less than 2 years, but more than a year, somewhere in that amount of time. Other questions or comments? We've got another 20 minutes worth that we could do here. If there aren't, we can stop early and let you renew your strength. Any other questions? This is your opportunity. Yes, Quad?
Yes.
Yeah, this is a couple of things come through in that work of Zwingli's, along with his clarity and certainty of the word. His somewhat quasi or pre-Puritan attitude is what's shown here, his negative principle of things, lifestyle matters that ought to be ruled out in the Christian life, where he's much more puritanical in the sense of applying the law to the area of sanctification than Luther would be. So that's the main thing that comes out of that. But the other is the verbal inspiration approach comes through, as in most of Zwingli's writings, in a stronger way than it does in Luther. Luther speaks of the word in general as the message of God. Zwingli is more precise than that, probably reflecting his humanist training. Yeah. If nothing else, there's no reason to hold you. I'll let you do your preparation. We'll trust and pray that things will go well tomorrow. And I'll try to get them back to you expeditiously so you know where you stand.